Tonight we resume our study of the Great Commission. We had some preliminary things to say about that last week. If you've been with us for the last couple of weeks, we got into John and talked about Jesus. He's there in the bank and the 153 fish and related some information from John's account about the commission. But now we start to focus on Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And we are going to be spending a fair amount of time in these three. We'll probably need at least two sessions for Matthew. And in just a little bit, we'll read from Matthew chapter 28, verses 16 through 20. Before we do that, I do want to go back and look at some additional preliminary material. When you look at the people on our planet, thinking about the Great Commission, it's roughly 7 billion people. We're probably a few people north of that right now. And when you look at the first century, clearly there were not 7 billion people on the planet, but there were still quite a few. If you think about the apostles, Jesus has been raised from the dead, and he says, guys, I want you to go where? I want you to go and talk to all nations. And you're just 11 people. I think that probably would have been a little overwhelming to me had I been an apostle. And I'm thinking, how is that going to work? How's that going to be done? But these fellows, they were willing to dig in. They had the commission. They understood the commission. And they did their best to carry it out. And such needs to be true for us. We sometimes talk about Bible authority. And that can involve a lot of different aspects. One of the things that you talk about or discuss when it comes to Bible authority is generic and specific authority. For example, if God says, I want you to meet, and I want you to meet on Sunday. Well, that's specific. He specified the day. But are there not also some things that would be general about that? God said, I want you to meet on the first day of the week or Sunday. What's not specified? All right, where are you meet? Are you going to meet in a building? Are you going to meet in a building that you've built or paid for that you're renting? Could you meet under a tree? Sure. Could you meet in a private home? Sure. Those things have not been specified. What else when it comes to general authority? God said meet and meet on this day, but he's not told us when. Or he's not told us the time. So we could meet at 12:01 if that worked best for us. It's probably not the best time to ask people to come out. Or we could meet at 7 or 10 or 2 or whatever time of that 24-hour period. What else is he not specified? All right. How long? Now, some people might say, well, because we're driving X number of miles or minutes, we don't want to come out for a five-minute service, and that's probably true. But you wouldn't necessarily want to come out and be here for 10 hours either. So those things are going to be at the in the judgment realm of people in a local congregation. When you think about evangelism, some statistics have said, and this is probably about right, that only 5 to 10% of members in a lot of congregations actively try to share their faith with someone in a typical year. And if that's true in some places, that's certainly not God's will. You also find, as you look at some stats, that there are more than 100,000 people who die each day. That's a lot of folks. If you have angels, 100,000 people a day. And if you break that down a little bit more, that's more than 6,000 people an hour. So you look at the clock right now and you think by the time that we leave tonight, about 6,000 plus people will have gone to meet their maker. And that should impress on us the urgency when it comes to evangelism. You've probably heard this somewhere. It's old information, but I think it bears repeating from time to time, especially in classes like this. If one Christian converted just 5 people in a year, and those converts did this as well, there'd be 25 Christians by the end of year 2. At the end of year 3, if that same process were followed, you'd have 125 Christians. By year 4, the number would climb to 625. At the end of year 5, you'd have 3,125 Christians. And then by year 6, you'd have 15,625 Christians. At the end of year 14, you'd have more than 6 billion Christians. So that's obviously not going to work quite like that. We know what Jesus talked about when he gave the parable of the sower, the seed, and you're going to have a lot of people who will simply say no, but still, the numbers don't lie when you look at them that way, that it is possible to grow. We see that with the church in the early times and even now in some places. One other quick point, and then we'll read our text. You have some places, and this is true not only for religion, but it might be in business, it might be in sports, and then Don will go to you in just a second. But sometimes people are number conscious, and they say, well, let's look at the numbers. You have sometimes the other philosophy where people say, well, numbers don't matter. Let's just go ahead and do the best we can and leave the numbers up to God. Well, there's some truth in both of those positions. When you look at the words in the New Testament, you find that there's a word, arithmos. Well, that sounds a bit like what our word arithmetic. And as you look at that word, anybody want to guess about a book where you find it sometimes? Well, I'm thinking New Testament. That probably would be a very good guess if we had the Old Testament books on the list, but we don't for this question, just New Testament books. Where do you read about arithmos? The book, I don't know who, Marcia or Joe, I don't know who said that, but the book of Acts. God was paying attention to numbers. And one of the passages would be Acts chapter 4 and verse 4. Based on that, I would not say that God is completely unconcerned about numbers. I mean, he does pay attention to that, and we should also give some consideration to that. But at the same time, you also have cases like Noah where, you know, the good's being done, the people are receiving the information, and they're simply not responsive. Don, back to you.
Well, back to your comment about the meeting on Sunday, as the example given in Acts. In Florida, congregations where we've gone to, they, because of lack of interest, for whatever reason, attendance, they dispense with the Sunday evening service. And some of these churches, about like 200 or 300, Sunday morning, and not enough to sustain an evening service. Even the other churches, where they're down like 60 or 70, they sustain and support an evening service. Now, how does that square with Hebrews?
I don't think it does. You will find, again, every congregation is going to be different for a lot of reasons. You will find that some of those congregations have quote-unquote disbanded, but they're going to a small group meeting. So just because there's not a Sunday night meeting, that does not mean that they're not meeting. It simply means that they're not meeting at the building. So you might find in some cases you have a congregation, maybe somewhat sizable, 200 or 300 or more, and they'll have a small number of people meet at the building in case somebody comes in as a visitor, and then they'll have some other house congregations, if you will. And then you'll find some other congregations that have gone kind of the opposite extreme. They just say pretty much lack of interest. And we're going to just shut down for Sunday evening. You know, there are a lot of passages. You think about seeking first the kingdom. What are you doing on Sunday night? Now, if you were, there have been some congregations that have decided on Sunday afternoon, Sunday evening, we're going to do some evangelistic work. Now, if that's going to be your choice, I don't know that I can fault them. I think that that's probably a good, productive use of time. Might that be the best choice in every place? Possibly not. But you get down to what I would refer to as the motivation. Why are you doing what you are doing? And if it's just that people are not going to come, then that would seem to indicate that there are some deep-rooted problems in that congregation.
Yeah, the large church I was talking about, they do have small groups, but the small groups don't add up to near what the Sunday morning service is for.
Yeah.
So,
you know, small groups can be a good thing. There are certainly some positive things about that. You can also have some small groups that end up going every which way. And, you know, it just becomes kind of a chit-chat session. There's not much Bible involved with that. There's no spiritual leadership sometimes in the groups. Some congregations that have done that and done that well, they've said we're going to have some accountability as far as trying to figure out who's there and who's not. Everybody's put into a group if a congregation goes that way. And they have some prepared material, almost like a Bible class, where you would say, you know, if this congregation, everybody's studying the same material on Sunday morning or Wednesday night, they would say, that's what we're going to do. And you might want to be on this side of town or that side of town because of proximity or getting to know some people, maybe have an elder in those groups, or maybe rotate the elders. There's some ways that that can be done in an effective way. But then there are some other cases where it's just kind of a free-for-all, and it's not good.
It is structured because the topic is basically off the sermon that morning.
Okay.
So they do have all focus on that, all groups focus on that.
Yeah. But again, there are some downsides. And one of the downsides would be, you know, I'm simply not interested in that. And accountability can become an issue as well. That it? Okay, let's go back and pick up with Matthew chapter 28, starting with 16 and reading down through the end of the chapter, verse 20. But the 11 disciples went into Galilee, unto the mountain where Jesus had appointed them. And when they saw him, they worshipped him, but some doubted. And Jesus came to them and spake unto them, saying, all authority hath been given unto me in heaven and on earth. Go ye therefore and make disciples of all the nations, baptizing them into the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all things whatsoever I commanded you, and lo, I am with you always, even unto the end of the world. We're probably familiar with most of that, but one of the statements that is shocking to me in the commission, and really in the whole book of Matthew, is found there back in verses 16 and 17. There were some people who were what? They were doubters. Who were the doubters? It almost sounds like some of the apostles were. Unless you've got some people besides the 11, and you have that statement about the 11, I was going to say back there in verse 16, some people suggest that there were others besides the 11. Maybe so. I think that, in my mind, is not all that definitive. It's a little difficult to prove. So if that is a reference to some of the apostles, you begin to see that even at this time, things are still not quite on sure footing. And maybe that helps explain why in the book of Acts, remember, Jesus is appearing to them over the period of about 40 days, more than a month, before he goes back to heaven, because these guys really needed to be secure in what they were believing and what they were going to be teaching. Ray?
Thomas was a doubter to begin with there, too.
Yeah. Now, he got on board. I mean, my Lord and my God. But yes.
Not much before this.
Yes. So like I say, there's still some shakiness there on the part of some people, perhaps the apostles. And that really is amazing. Okay, let's make a couple of the quick points here. Why include that detail? We've often said before that God just doesn't throw arbitrary details in the text. Why include, especially if this is a reference to some of the apostles, why say that their faith was a little shaky?
Well, we're not going to come across everybody that's going to believe. And
all right.
The early Christians, the disciples here have issues. What do you expect when we go door to door?
Okay, I think there's that. Carol, did you have a thought?
Mm-hmm. But maybe to help us not be so discouraged when we have times of doubt.
Yeah, both of those thoughts are good, but I think we can stick one more point in here that's also really essential. Anybody else want to take a shot at it? Tim?
Well, there's times when all of our faith is we doubt.
Yeah. Or the faith isn't quite as strong as it should be, or it's not as good. And you can have those times and think, well, you know, how effective can I be in God's service? Well, what did Jesus say? He didn't say, well, we've been at it for 3 years and you guys should have finally figured it out by now. I'm going to give you the boot and find somebody else. He's still stuck with them. So when there are times where faith is maybe weak, is struggling, it's imperfect, or you can look at somebody else and you think, wow, I sure wish that my faith were like his faith or her faith or their faith. And maybe that's something that's just done occasionally, or maybe that's something that's done on a regular basis. Come back to Matthew 28 and see what you find, perhaps with at least some of the apostles. And realize that Jesus still loved them. He said, you are still useful to me, and I'm going to put you to work in my kingdom. And that's exactly what he did with all of them. Very, very comforting passage. I think this, as far as the chronology, Betty, I'm going to put this shortly after the resurrection. And that's, yes, again, this is still new. I mean, maybe you've got a couple weeks that have gone by, but still, this is a lot to absorb. I mean, it's like the person who is just hit with big chunks of emotional changes. Think about Job, for example. I mean, it's wave one, and then it's wave two, and then it's wave three. And just by the, you feel like you sort of recover or can absorb the first tsunami of waves, and all of a sudden, you know, here comes another one. And it's just really difficult to process. And for these guys, you know, you've got Peter's denials, and you've got the empty tomb and so forth, and just so many things had happened that they just had to be in a state of emotional turmoil. And I think that goes back to what Ray said as far as Thomas, I will not believe. You guys have come and given the reports. The women have made the reports. I've got to see him for myself. Don?
Well, I think they had an emotional roller coaster.
Sure.
The death on the cross. 3 days, he had risen. They had seen him. He spent 40 days with him. Then he goes, gone. They probably say, well, what's next? Even though he told them what's next.
Yeah.
The day of Pentecost hadn't come. So that when they finally, understand what it's all about.
Yeah, and even at Pentecost, they still didn't have everything completely figured out. I mean, they knew the basics, but it's going to be some time before Peter starts to figure out things with Gentiles. He's got to have the information given to him in a special way, Cornelius. So it was a learning process. Take that and tie that in with what we've been talking about in the Sunday morning class. Remember Saul? I mean, he's converted. He's starting to do some teaching. He can give out the basics, but where's he got to go? He's got to hoof it off to where? Arabia for how long?
3 years.
So if you have him, in spite of the great conversion experience that he had, he's out there on the road and so forth. I mean, this is just a lot to absorb for anybody. But bear in mind who these guys are. What was their religious faith? They were Jew. They'd grown up. That was the only thing that they knew. Moses was the great guy. And Jesus comes along and says, just block all that out as far as religion. I mean, you're still going to use that as far as teaching, but you will no longer have any association with that as far as how to please God. You have this major religious shift. And it was a huge emotional upheaval for these fellas. And I think that's why you begin to see some of the fierce opposition from the Jews as well. Because, you know, we know what Moses is. He was that messenger from God, and you're trying to upend all that. Is that it? Let's go back and see where we left off. We're not told, and Carol touched on this, I think, a bit ago, we're not told what Jesus thought about the doubters. But we do know what he said. He comes to these fellas, and what's he say? That key point in verse 18. He comes and says, all authority has been given unto me, and that authority is on heaven and earth. Now here's something. This dawned on me today, and I might be completely wrong about this. I'm going to toss this out at a preacher's meeting, but we'll give you guys a first shot at it. All authority on heaven and earth. Do you remember there's another statement in the book of Revelation, Revelation chapter 1 and verse 18. John said Jesus has the keys to a couple places. Keys, another way to describe authority. Jesus has the keys to Hades, or King James probably says hell. But he's got the keys to Hades as well as?
Kingdom.
No?
Decree.
Or death? Death and Hades. Now, before I say any more, I'll let you take a shot at that. The keys to Hades. I mean, at the end of time, you know, Hades is going to be destroyed. He'll bring all the people back from the Hadean realm, so I don't think that's too difficult. But what about the keys to death? Well, I think that's... Well, certainly you could argue both. I mean, he's got the keys to take care of physical death as far as raising the body at the end of time, John 5, 28 and 29. He's also got the power when it comes to spiritual death to free people. Anything else, though, that we might be able to tie in with that?
He is the key, though, to eternal life.
Well, there's that. I'm wondering if maybe, at least hinted at there, is not the Lord's ability, providentially, I'm not talking about miraculously, but providentially to prolong or shorten life.
Well, it says that they have control over our days, that God numbers our days.
I think that may be hinted at in Revelation chapter 1 and verse 18. When we pray for people in the hospital, what do we pray for typically?
Healing.
All right. What are we asking for? Stated another way.
Longer life.
And don't we pray sometimes for the opposite? You find somebody who is in a bad state, maybe in a nursing home, there's no hope of recovery, and sometimes people have prayed, you know, they've lived their life, they're a faithful Christian, God, let them go peacefully. I can't help but think Revelation 1:18 may be tied in with that. He's got the power of death. The reverse of that, which of course is not stated, is he's also got the power of life. So it's an interesting thought, at least to me and perhaps to you, when you think about Jesus' authority. Anything that you might ask in that point, Don?
I agree that he has the power. He uses it.
Well, you can have power, but not use it, obviously. So the question then becomes, if Jesus has that power, Revelation 1:18 indicates that he has, you might ask this question, why wouldn't he use it? If his people are seeking, perhaps, longer life, or they're praying for longer life on behalf of another, then would we be willing to say that Jesus would never answer that prayer? He would just say, I don't want to touch that. If we agree that deity has some involvement with that prayer, then that authority is being used. The same would be true of the flip side of that. If you say that God, please let that person pass on to the next life, again, we're asking for deity to use that power, in this case, of death. You're not convinced?
Well,
you're thinking about it.
No, I'm not convinced because...
Okay.
God's ways are not our ways.
Sure.
Our ways are not God's ways.
Yeah.
So
So for us to try to define definitively, does power, does God use that power, or does he not use that power?
Well, but we are asking him to use the power, though, in some...
We are asking,
okay. Well, you could ask that question about any aspect of God. Yeah. Now, we do know in the Old Testament, you go back and you look at Hezekiah. Things were not looking all that swell for him. And he turns and he asks God for life. And that prayer was answered. Some years were granted to his life. You, for example, thinking about any others as far as a request for life. You think about Paul... and was it Onesiphorus? Paul said that the Lord had mercy on him and healed him. Again, I think there would be another example of God using that power to restore life and by implication also lengthening life since he didn't die.
And Paul's word where he said it'd be better for him to leave, but he needed to stay here for those.
Sure.
That he could still speak to and things. I think of that from time to time that there's a man that really worked for God, and he had the right idea, and he wasn't asking God to take him now or
right.
leave him, but he understood God's will.
Yeah. Okay. In the Philippians?
When we pray, we expect an answer to our prayer, and sometimes it's no, sometimes it's wait, sometimes...
Yeah.
It's granted. Does he not use his power in granting our prayers?
Well, if you proceed down the path of you saying that God has power but he doesn't use it, that at some point can get you into some trouble. Now, there certainly would be some times where God has the power to do something but doesn't. And maybe that would violate his will. That would make sense. You may have some other times where God could use his power at this point and doesn't because that's not the best time. But to unless you're dealing with something that, again, is a clear, direct violation of God's will, to say that he always has the power to do something, and he never uses the power to do that, to me, I think that you're maybe in quicksand at that point. That's going to be...
I wouldn't say he never uses it. That wasn't what I said.
No, no. I'm just saying, for a certain area of life, in this case, if we're talking about the certain area being the ability to lengthen life or the ability to shorten life, just those two areas. If you say that God has the ability in those areas, but he never, ever uses the ability in those two areas, that, to me, I think is super shaky ground. Because, again, you're now making a very definitive statement about God as far as what he's not going to do. And I didn't want to affirm that he would always do that, but that the possibility is there. All right, well, now we've got a couple hands going up. Maxine, we'll start with you, and then, I don't know, Carol or Gary, and then we'll come back to Joe, and then probably Don.
Me?
Yeah, you first.
But if he never answers or never does anything, what would be the need to pray at all?
Yes, again, that's part of the equation that you have to factor in there, that if he's not going to, if he has the power and he never uses it, again, bearing in mind the fact that it's not going to violate his will, he's not going to do that. You know, you could say, God, put a new car here in the auditorium so somebody can drive it out. Obviously, I mean, you can ask that and ask that and ask that, but he's not going to do that for multiple reasons. But if you're asking something consistent with his will, there's no reason to ask for something consistent with his will if he's never going to do it. And over in the book of 1 John, John said, if we ask anything according to his will, he hears us. Well, would it be God's will for some people to recover? We know that's the case, because what did Jesus do sometimes? You have some people who are dead. You have some people who are about dead or dying, and what's he do? He brings them back to life. You find that Jesus sometimes dealt with sick and deceased children. What did he do? Brings them back to life. And do you not find that there were some sick people who died? How do we know? Well, they're dead. I mean, he didn't, you know, preserve life, you know, for 2,000 plus years. So it is God's will for people to sometimes die. Okay, Carol, I think we move on to you.
Christian, this guy's life isn't extended, so he doesn't become a Christian now. Is that predestination?
No. Remember, Romans 2 and verse 4, Paul talked about the goodness of God, and he doesn't want any to be lost. 2 Peter chapter 3 and verse 9, not predestination at all. But you have God knowing the hearts of people. He wants people to be saved. And if a person needs another month or 6 months or a year to live, to me, when you go back and you look at those passages as far as God's will, here is someone who needs that additional information. Let's look at it in terms of Acts chapter 8. What did the eunuch need to become a Christian? All right, he said, I need somebody to guide me, right? What did God do? All right, why did God ensure that someone went? Because God doesn't want any to perish, and God is long-suffering. So flip that around a little bit. Here's a person who doesn't necessarily need someone to teach them. What does he need? He needs more time to think. So if God is going to do it over here for this guy who simply needs a teacher, would not fairness demand that God follows that same line of reasoning over there? To me, that's absolutely consistent.
And God would know this.
Yes. Yeah. Just like he knew what this fellow needed, that is a teacher. He knew when the right time was to have somebody go see him, the right place, all the right circumstances. He does the same over here. All right, let's see. Joe, we're back to you.
Okay. We have the parable of the rich man, a rich farmer. He said, you know, God to blame it. Tonight your soul shall be part of thee. And just like that, he wasn't expecting to die. Things were going so well for him. But then just one night, God said, okay, it's time to go.
Yeah.
Then you have David after he had numbered Israel. And with the census, had that judgment on him. He had to pick between a few things, and he picked the one, and he had 70,000 the angel of death had killed, and then God said, okay, that's enough, stop.
Yeah.
Like if, okay, the killing could keep going on, but God said, well, stop.
Yeah. The power of life and death is certainly within the hand of deity. Spiritually, when you think about the end of time, the unsaved are going to go to life. The saved are going to go to life, the unsaved are going to go to a spiritual death. And that's also, I think, reflected in the examples that you gave as far as physical death. There is that power of both that Don alluded to earlier. All right, Don, we're back to you.
Oh, back to me. Well, when we pray, don't we? Always when we're asking for God to save a person with cancer or some terminal type disease, we always say, if it be your will.
Sure.
Now, we may pray for more than one person that has cancer, similar cancer, terminal cancer. One person dies, the other person miraculously lives. Does God determine the one that dies and the one that lives?
You have different forces in the world. Remember that God is not the only force out there. Now, certainly he's the strongest one. But you do have, and again, I'm not going to presuppose that I know all the ins and outs. Maybe that's the best place to begin. But you do have a lot of things. If God wills something and says, this is going to be the way it goes, there's nothing that's going to be that overrides that. But we also recognize that we may have the devil involved in the process. We realize that those people who are being treated for cancer, there are going to be some people who are involved, and you have a human element there. There can be the element which is going to be helpful, or maybe it's going to be detrimental. There are a lot of things going on. We do know that all die. That's a promise. Hebrews 9 and verse 27. Judgment comes to all. All people die. And whether that's going to be sooner or whether that's going to be later, whether God chooses to delay that, whether he chooses to not delay that, each case is going to be different, Don. So we would all be wrapped up in knots, including me, if we tried to go ahead and dissect that. But we are told that to pray for people. You have over there in James chapter 5 some information about praying for the sick. Some people think that was in a miraculous context. But whether it was or not, you still have the fact that it is right to pray for the sick. And then we depend on God for the right outcome. And the same would be true for life and death. So that's, I think, about as far as I can go with that, because it is well above both of our pay grades if you combine them. Sherman, did you have a thought? I thought there was one more on the right. All right, Tim?
We somehow get a fog around us, and we forget that God knows the hearts of everybody.
Sure.
And he knows the hearts of those who are not going to ever respond. And Jesus knew that. Because he made the statement that when you preach to somebody and there's no response from them, shake the dust off your sandals and move on to somebody else. And he knew that. And when some of these people who are given the same chance as others don't take advantage of it. God knew they weren't going to take advantage of it, and that it was a waste of time for them to, you know, be preached to and preached to and preached to.
Yeah.
And so these other people that do respond are doing what he wants them to do. Those are the people there that are going to be spreading his word. Those are the ones he's interested in. And at the same time, the scriptures tell us that the prayers of a righteous man availeth much. Mm-hmm. Now, he knew the heart of Job. He knew the heart of Cornelius. He knew, you know, he knew the heart of the eunuch. He knew that all these people were going to respond the way he wanted them to.
It's a great point. Let me take that, and then I'm going to go out on a limb just a little bit. Remember Luke chapter 19? Jesus, about triumphal entry time. He's in this crowd. Everybody's cheering. And who's that small guy that Jesus calls out? Zacchaeus. How many people do you think were in that crowd? Bunches. Maybe thousands of people. And yet, out of all those folks, who does Jesus call out? This one guy who's sitting up in a tree, who's a tax collector, and probably wasn't liked very much. Why go after him? You think all the people in those crowds were bad-hearted? I don't think that. Why pick Zacchaeus? Well, that may have been the ideal moment for him, for whatever reason. I mean, maybe he was thinking about certain things that day, just like you have in Acts chapter 8, the example of the Ethiopian eunuch. I mean, that time, we talk about striking when the iron hot is hot. That's what happened in Acts chapter 8. Zacchaeus, in Luke chapter 19, it also seems that the iron was hot. He knew the heart. Another example, and you can go back and look at the ones that you talked about. Cornelius, again, the same deal is there. You think about John chapter 4. Who do you have there? Jesus meets up. A lot of people in Samaria, right? You think they were all bad folks? No. I mean, the Jews didn't think highly of them, but I mean, you probably had some decent people there. And yet, who's Jesus pick? This woman, who is not the most moral woman out of all the people. I mean, there are probably some other people in Samaria who had much better morals than this woman did. And yet he picks her. He knows the heart. Now, let's go out on a limb a little bit, Don. Let's go back to where I was chatting with you just a couple of minutes ago. Two people have cancer. We pray for both. Both eventually die, right? This person that we prayed for, person A has cancer, and they are healed from the cancer, and they stay healed for life. Person B doesn't get healed. And let's say that we prayed equally, the same number of Christians prayed equally for both parties, and they both died. It's going to sound hard-hearted, but in the end, is there really any difference? If both are non-Christians?
If they're both non-Christians?
Yeah.
No.
All right. Again, this puts me on dangerous ground. I don't want to sound like I'm God or anything, but if you're praying for both, even if both recovered, would that substantially change anything? They both die outside of Christ, and all die. And maybe that's also part of the answer. Not that God is unconcerned about both. But maybe this one, there were some other considerations. Maybe there was a child that somehow needed to be raised. Maybe this one was going to affect a child in a certain way where that child would, for example, maybe later become a Christian in life. Some circumstances that we can't see right now how that will lined up. But maybe there was a reason such as that ensuring that person was cured would not have helped the person per se, but it was going to help some other people. Whereas this person, their life was lost to cancer. But again, there was not going to be any substantial benefit. Now again, I'm not saying that that's always true across the board. Maybe that's never true. But at least as you try to think through some of that, that's a thought worth considering.
Don't argue with that.
Okay.
And, you know, whichever way God goes, we may not understand
that. Sure, that's absolutely right.
Jesus had a purpose for everything he did.
Yeah.
And we don't understand that purpose, but down the road, like Tim was saying, there is a purpose for it.
Yeah, and that's where you get back to, we can't see the big picture. But when God can see, remember I had a sermon not too long ago as far as hypothetical knowledge in God. Anybody remember the sermon? That God knows all the hypotheticals. By that, if you weren't here for that lesson, I talked about the fact that if you married, or if you are married, you could point to any other person who's ever lived or is living now, and you could say to God, what if I had married him? Or what if I had married her? Or what if I had married at a different time in life? Whatever you could throw out as a possibility, God could tell you how it would have gone. Now, if you're someone who can lay out all the possible hypotheticals, I want you to have the ear for my prayer, especially if God got the power to help, because you know all the hypotheticals. I mean, you know, I maybe can see two or three things, and maybe one of those two things or maybe both of those things are great, but maybe there's a third option that's better, or maybe there are ten other options that are better than my two. And I can't, even though I can see perhaps the two best options, I still can't see all the ultimate repercussions of those actions or those answered prayers immediately or in the near future or even in the distant future. Because can't the actions that we take sometimes affect people generations and generations down the line? They can. And sometimes as you look at certain people, not just a few people, but sometimes an entire nation. And yet God is able to somehow balance all that. And I mean, it literally is mind-boggling. All right, we really got off track, but an interesting discussion. Anything else before we kind of head back to where we wanted to be? Stan?
Does that take Jesus raising Lazarus, Paul's raising of Eutychus? Does that take that out of the realm of the miraculous?
Can you explain that? I'm not sure I follow the question.
If Jesus has the power over life and death to give Lazarus his life back, wouldn't it be miraculous?
Well, remember, miraculous means the suspension of natural law.
Right.
All right. Natural law doesn't allow somebody to be put in the grave and then just somehow come back after 4 days. So if somebody's been put in the grave and they come back 4 days later, that is a miracle. Miraculous power has been used.
But extending life is not a miracle.
When we think, for example, if we go back to the cancer illustration, if we're praying for someone and they get the right doctors, let's say that perhaps the right drug came out just a week before that the person is now going to need. Before, you know, that was available, there would have been no hope. But now it just so happens that the right drug has shown up and they have access to it. Or maybe the doctor is one of the doctors that was involved in the research and says, I can get you the drug because I'm on the review committee, or I've been part of the group that found this. Those things line up in just the right way. There again, you're back into the area of providence versus the miraculous. Okay, Ray?
We talk about somebody that's dying of cancer or something, so we have, say, myself in there, I'm praying that the person will die peaceful. Mm-hmm. And we have another good, faithful Christian that comes in and is praying for that individual to be healed and to be over with, and give them more years of life. Now, God can't answer both of
clearly
them, that I can see that, but we're both very sincere in our prayers to God of that. Well, as far as what we can see, that would be best for the person.
Yeah, and you do have a number of examples where you might refer to competing interests. Mm-hmm. Yeah, not that we would necessarily say that this is a good example, but you have sometimes competing teams. Two football teams, or maybe a couple players. Team A, I want to win, God, let us win. Well, the same thing as being prayed by Team B. So, as I said, that's not the best example, but it does show that there are people who are sometimes on very opposite sides of the fence. You have people who win with the weather. Sometimes people are praying fervently for rain. And then you have some other people who have, maybe they have an outing that's coming up, and they pray the opposite. And again, one of those prayers needs to be given a no, so the other one is answered in a positive way. And again, how God does that and how he decides, you know, that's going to be up to him. But you might tie into that answer. We typically see things in the short term. We don't want rain for this day or this week. But there could be some ultimate consequences to that. Maybe not getting rain that week will mean that there are going to be some people who end up starving. Some of God's people in a foreign country because not enough grain was harvested that year or whatever it might be. And that's, we get back to a God who sees the big picture. But for us, we have that very limited vision. And sometimes, and that's where you get back to praying that God's will be done, because that's smart. All right, Betty?
Is to the prayer, that's the best. So
scenario?
Well, let me toss in something else here that'll jazz things up a little bit more. Do you remember what James said? You have not because you
ask not.
So go back and state your point again, and then I'm going to hit you back with what James said.
The outcome of whatever your prayer has been, and whatever that outcome, whether it be answer or not answer, that is the best scenario.
Okay.
The best scenario.
All right. Betty's asking whether or not the response to the prayer is the best outcome. Isn't there another option based on the passage that I just cited? The outcome might be based on what? A lack of asking. I'd suggest there may sometimes be a default position.
No, I'm saying you've asked. Yeah, I understand.
Okay.
If you have asked.
Yeah.
And it still comes out a different answer than what you asked for.
Yeah. The best outcome. Yeah, now that may not be the best outcome for you, personally.
Yeah,
right.
I understand that, but
right. All things considered.
As far as what happens,
yes.
God has said this is for the best.
Yes.
This is the best.
Yeah. What's the old saying? You can't satisfy who?
Everybody.
How often?
All
the time. Would you say that that's a reasonable conclusion to draw concerning prayer? It is. I mean, sometimes you have to do the best overall. And exactly God, how that works, and sometimes I think that God may do the opposite, that you might have someone who is helped or blessed in a certain way, and there may be some others. So you're bearing all those facts in mind, and again, it really leaves you with a great impression about God as far as how magnificent he is. And it's not just us. You could even, I think, apply that to nature as well. You know, we've got some birds that need to be cared for over here, don't we? Remember, God, does he feed the birds?
Yes.
He does. But does he have some other things that need to be tended to?
Sure.
All right. Well, what's he going to feed the birds with?
Nature.
Well, all right, nature, maybe some insects, some worms, things like that. Well, do you think the insects and the worms also have some interest? You think they want to be food for lunch? Probably not. So, you've got some competing interests, don't you? The birds on the one hand, but you got the insects on the other. And both want to survive. But somebody's going to lose out. And sometimes that happens in the physical realm too. All right, Don, back to you.
Good question. Your answer to miraculous. Define it again for me.
Okay, miraculous activity is a suspension of natural law.
Okay, who gave natural law?
Well, God set natural law in order.
So, if God gave natural law, he allowed natural law to take its course. And that's what happens in a lot of cases.
That's true. And that's why I say you have to factor that in as well. Somebody gets sick, and there are going to be some times where you'll have a non-religious person, and they're able to beat a deadly disease like cancer. Why? Maybe because natural law. We've talked before about the fact that when you find people who, for example, gamble, or you look at the people who claim to heal people, there are going to be some quote-unquote healings, or there are going to be some people who win at gambling just because of sheer numbers. If you tell 10,000 people that there's somebody here with a disease and you're sick and you're going to walk out and you're going to get better, you're going to be healed, there's an excellent chance that somebody... Don't we find people in life who have some issues early in life and at some point those issues seem to resolve themselves? Sometimes things just seem to kind of disappear, work out on their own.